Okay, we're back with another episode of More from Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Once again, I just want to quickly remind everyone that you will be giving talks in a number of cities in North America this year. This week we have LA, which is sold out. Congrats. That'll be fun. And then coming up, we have Dallas, Austin, Portland, Vancouver, Toronto, DC, and ending in New York City again. So if you want to see Sam, now is the time to do it. While touring can be a lot of fun, it's also hard work, not to mention you have to stand up there for nearly 2 hours straight.
Yeah. The talk keeps getting longer. I keep trying to cut it back, but events happen. So yeah.
Yeah, I've learned to stop making any suggestions. I keep asking you to cut 15 minutes in, then you add 15 minutes. So I'm just going to be quiet. But it's a great show and it's a cool experience to see you deliver it live. And anyone wanting to buy tickets can head over to samharris.org now and you can find all the info there. Okay, so many things happening that I don't even know where to begin. From Rene Good, ICE in general, Greenland, tariffs on the EU for intervening in Greenland, the potential collapse of NATO, and I haven't even gotten to Iran and Venezuela and Maduro might as well have happened a year ago. And well, it seems like
that was just like 2 weeks ago. I mean, it's been an incredible 2 weeks.
It seems like the Epstein files have successfully fallen out of the news again. And do we even have time to cover the latest round of anti-Semitism? Plus, I want to get your take on prediction markets and gambling apps, the latest on AI, and discuss Ben Shapiro's appearance on Gavin Newsom's podcast and anything you hope to discuss with Ben when he's on your podcast next month and more. Let's see how much of this we can get to today. So which emergency would you like to start with? How about ICE and Rene Good?
Yeah, I guess we could. I did speak about that on Scott Galloway's podcast at some length. So some people have seen that, I think. But yeah, I'm happy to cover that.
Yeah, just why don't you give us a little synopsis of what you said over there and then we can go from there.
Well, I mean, there's so many aspects to it that are regrettable. I mean, there's nothing about this that is normal. The more general problem is that we're getting lulled into a sense of a new normal that is so aberrant, right? It's so unacceptable, or it should be so unacceptable to everyone. I mean, this should be just a completely nonpartisan feeling of revulsion that is coming over the country for what we're seeing here. I mean, just the behavior of ICE, the fact that you have, you know, masked and quite obviously poorly recruited and poorly trained people expressing a totally unprofessional level of belligerence to everyone in sight, right? I mean, this is not normal policing. I mean, it's not even close to even normal bad policing, right? I mean, so it's just how anyone has felt that this is defensible, you know, right of center. It just boggles the mind. I mean, we're talking about people who were upset over the Twitter files. Just remember that, right? I mean, that was the level of Orwellian federal government overreach that had them fucking vomiting online, right? I mean, just the calls from Joe Biden when he's not in power, right? He's just got a presidential campaign and he's calling Twitter to have naked photos of his son removed. And he's just asking, right? And this is the thing that gets the Matt Taibbis of the world just around the clock, 24/7, this their entire career to chase this down. And now we have got thousands upon thousands of maniacs in the street breaking people's windows and hauling them out of their cars and throwing them on the pavement without any probable cause. And these can be immigrants, they can be citizens. They're using flashbang grenades on peaceful protesters. They're using people's kids as bargaining chips in negotiations to get people to surface from homes. And I mean, it's just, the footage is awful. But what is even more awful than the violence, the totally unwarranted violence we're seeing, is the government's response to the worst excesses of that violence when people react. So, I mean, the killing of Rene Good was, in my view, totally unjustified. I mean, we can dissect that a little more if you want. But the most shocking thing was the lies that came from the president and vice president and Kristi Noem, everyone on down immediately, right? And they were not even normal lies. I mean, they were impossible lies. They were lies being told when everyone could see what happened from three different sides. She's being described as a terrorist who tried to kill ICE agents. There is no way of looking at that footage to justify that claim. That was obvious from the beginning, and no one, I mean, these aren't errors. These aren't normal errors. No one corrects an error. No one apologizes. No one says, oh yeah, so we had some initial reports. We got that wrong. Obviously, we got to investigate this. There's a sense of completely unprofessional contempt being expressed for half of American society. I mean, this is the framing of everything is that we have an enemy within And we are now going to war against that enemy. And the enemy within is basically everyone who didn't vote for Trump and who isn't going to ratify his excesses at every turn. I mean, this is, if you saw this happening in any other society, you could safely assume that those people were living under a dictatorship. This is not hyperbole. I mean, I'm not saying we live under a dictatorship, you know, fully achieved at this point, but what we're seeing in the streets of Minneapolis and what we're seeing communicated from the Oval Office on down is fascist-style governance. There's just no question about that.
Yeah, and according to Damon Linker's article, the Substack piece, which the main point was that whatever you think you're seeing in the media, it's worse. I mean, it seems like every quote said something to the effect of the media is just not conveying to you just how awful this is. And so whatever you just said and whatever you think we know, it's worse on the ground, apparently.
Yeah. It's hard to know what to do about it. I mean, obviously, I think people need to keep protesting. They should try to do that as safely as possible. So let's say the other side of this. Let's just bend over backwards to be charitable to ICE and the Trump regime. There's no question that some of what protesters do is unwise and illegal and almost certainly unnecessary to express their free speech opposition to what's happening. So, I mean, I'm sure there are maneuvers with people's cars blocking traffic, and it's still uncertain to me what Renee Good was doing that was illegal or not. But let's just price all of that in. Let's just say this is, you know, to some degree, you know, the fuck around and find out principle is operative. You shouldn't be doing dangerous, illegal things in order to protest. Okay, great. But what she clearly wasn't doing was trying to run over cops with her car. There was no reason to escalate this situation. This was not a situation that had to be violent, that was running off the rails. This was not, ICE officers weren't being threatened by anyone. They came in so aggressively and were, you know, shouting contradictory commands. Whatever you think about the first shot, I still think that was unjustifiable. But even if you're going to bend over backwards and say, all right, this is an officer who perceived, you know, any movement of the car to be imperiling his life. I mean, first of all, moron that he is, he's walking in front of the car. If he actually thought he was in a hostile situation, why would you walk in front of a car like that? You simply wouldn't. I mean, this is bad training, bad recruitment.
Bad common sense.
But just leave that aside. And what is he doing with his phone, right? He's making his own home movies of the situation. I mean, what are these ICE guys doing with their phones? I've heard that some of them are using facial recognition. Maybe that's the case. That's also a little weird and dystopian if they're running around doing facial recognition on everybody. We should have a public conversation about that. But again, leave that aside. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. He found himself in front of somebody's car. It started moving. He thought, again, idiotically, that the best way to stop a moving car, to keep yourself safe from it, is to shoot the driver at close range. I can't imagine any training suggests that's the case. But in any case, within a second, he was to the side of the car, not at all in harm's way, and then delivered two more shots to Renee Good and, you know, kind of ensuring that she was dead. The purpose of those shots were not self-defense. This is not a fleeing fugitive who has, you know, several murders on her record, and you know she's a threat to the public, right? So it's just, there's nothing about this that makes sense from a law enforcement point of view, and yet you have people defend. I mean, forget about all the liars and maniacs who are calling her a terrorist. And you know, Trump said the guy was in the hospital and lucky to be alive, right? That's the level of communication. But forget about all that. There's still people right of center defending this as somehow a kind of normative policing, that we want our law enforcement to come in this hot. And if you simply don't obey them, you have fucked around sufficiently so as to lose your life. Right. I mean, that's basically the center of narrative gravity over there. It's insane. And again, it's coming from people who, it's coming from the right, these people who get radicalized by every, or at least, you know, heretofore got radicalized by every overreach of federal power, right? I mean, think of, you know, Ruby Ridge that radicalized the entire, you know, far right for a generation, or Waco, right? I mean, this is what got Timothy McVeigh to blow up the federal building, right? It's like any intrusion of the feds, you know, coming into our lives. And what the feds are doing now is stopping traffic randomly and hauling people out of cars who are just driving home from work and throwing them on the pavement, restraining them and beating them up after they've been restrained. It's awful.
Do you think these videos, these horrifying videos, bode well for midterm elections for the Dems?
Well, I think, you know, technically everything Trump is doing now bodes well, because it's all quite unpopular, at least from the polls I've seen. You know, the ICE operations are unpopular. The Greenland stuff is unpopular. So, yeah, I mean, he's...
ACA subsidies, yeah.
The tariffs are unpopular. I mean, it's hard to know what he thinks he's accomplishing from a political point of view with any of this.
Yeah. And, you know, I know you had touched on the takeaway of what you think we should do as it's protesting. I wanted to get a sense of what you thought we could do. But before you answer that, I just want to show you a video clip of what I think you should not do.
Renee Good! All these comfortable white people who are living lavish, comfortable lives while children are dragged into concentration camps. You're living real life, nice lives with your lattes, doing absolutely nothing for your Latino and Somali brothers and sisters. You come here to a...
Listen, I think you want to model the civility you want to see in your society, right? So I just think whenever these things become oppressive to the rest of the citizenry, I just think it's counterproductive. I mean, that's what was so ridiculous about so many Black Lives Matter protests, where they would get in people's faces in cafes and, you know, aggressively force them to, you know, in some kind of struggle session to comply with, you know, to grant assent to the legitimacy of the protest, right? You've got, you know, it's just like, bend the knee right now or we're going to, you know, ruin your life. That's just not a way to win hearts and minds in any way. So
also, these are not leaders of the party. Yeah. There's a difference.
Yeah.
This is not the behavior of those that are leading that party.
Again, this is asymmetric political warfare. The right and, you know, the Trumpists have very few rules. You know, they'll dox people. They'll shatter all the norms that I think we're right to live by, you know, when we oppose our political opponents. So it's hard to know. I don't think Michelle Obama's aphorism has weathered the test of time. You know, when they go low, we go high. That probably admits of some exceptions, but I just don't think you want to be an unethical asshole at any point.
All right, somewhat related to ICE, the State Department is halting visa processing for migrants from 75 countries in its latest immigration crackdown. They're basically pausing entry for any applicants they fear would become reliant on taxpayer money if allowed into the U.S. What's wrong with that?
Well, I'm sure everything's wrong with it, given the people who are in charge, right? I mean, given that we're living in Stephen Miller's world, at least on this front. I mean, it's got to be unethical. It's got to be callous. It's got to be too blunt force in every application. So, I mean, so it's just, I'm sure there's nothing good about it. But in the abstract, I think we could admit that we, one, want to know who's coming into the country, which is to say we want a secure border. And two, we want to admit the people into the country who we want in the country, right? Who we think are going to add value on whatever level, whether they're high skilled or low skilled or refugees who we just have a compassionate policy around. We obviously don't want jihadists and Islamists and lunatics of, you know, any other ideological flavor. We don't want communists. We don't want Nazis. There's lots of people we don't want in this country, or we don't want more of, and we shouldn't be eager to import them intentionally or haphazardly. So that requires that we figure out who people are and have some orderly process of letting them in. And that's all fine. But again, we have, you know, the kinds of people who will separate families and put kids in cages running our immigration policy.
Wait, what happened to the $5 million visa where you could just...
I think that still exists. The golden visa, yeah.
Is that happening?
I think that happened, yeah. I don't know how many people bought it, but I think that is a thing, yeah.
That's like 100 scandals ago. I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
So people are buying and
I believe that. We'd have to fact check that, but I believe that happened, yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, clearly we know we want people in this country that have $5 million to spend on a visa.
Yeah.
All right, help me understand what's happening with Greenland.
Well, if I understood that, I would be, I think, the one person on Earth who does. It makes no sense because we have full access to Greenland. I mean, Denmark has been one of our best allies for, I think, 200 years. I think they lost more soldiers per capita than any other ally in our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? I mean, this is a country that has joined us even in our unpopular wars, I mean, wars that were unpopular in their own society, for better or worse. There's no reason we should be at odds with them, much less be mistreating them, much less be threatening to kill their soldiers, right? Which is effectively what we have done by saying we might you can do this the easy way or you can do this the hard way, and we might invade. Obviously, we risk shattering NATO if it isn't, you know, tacitly shattered already. I think it probably is. I don't think anyone thinks we would defend a country like Poland if Russia rolled in there now. So our Article 5 obligations, I think, are void. It makes no sense because we already have bases on there. We have older bases on there. I think at one point we had something like 17 military bases on Greenland. I think we have one now, but we have full access rights. We can do anything we want there with respect to defending Arctic sea lanes or, you know, mining for minerals. I mean, it's not a thing, this problem of Greenland not being available to us strategically. Why Trump thinks we need it for the, I mean, he said something like, you know, America needs it like psychologically or something. I mean, that just is.
Well, I thought he said it because he was worried that China or Russia wanted to take it.
Well, no, but if China or Russia attempted to take it, they would be attacking a NATO country, right? Which we're sworn to defend. It would be the same situation. This is something that has emerged from Trump's brain and the entire world has to deal with it. I mean, this is one of those cases. There are many, many cases like this, but this is certainly one where I think my evil Chauncey Gardner framing of Trump is actually accurate. I mean, so people have perhaps forgotten this book and film, the book Being There by Jerzy Kosinski and the film.
The movie of Peter Sellers, yeah.
I mean, so the gag for the film is that, you know, so Peter Sellers is this, you know, probably, you know, mentally retarded. Can we use that word?
Thanks to Trump, yes.
Yeah. the one thing Trump has given us. You know, he's a mentally challenged gardener who is thrust into a situation where, because of the situation around him, his sort of gnomic, you know, aphoristic and all too simple utterances are perceived to be the kind of the ultimate example of, you know, political wisdom, right? So he finds himself in, you know, just whist in the company of billionaires, and he's, you know, he's opining on, but he doesn't even know, he's not even consciously opining on anything. He's just talking about gardening. But every, you know, when he says something like, you know, every season changes, or, you know, in the spring, new shoots will grow. That is taken as like, now, you know, we're in the presence of the Buddha.
Or he also refrains from talking at moments and people think he's a genius for his silence.
Yeah. Yeah. So like everything gets, he just, the lens of timeless wisdom gets thrown over his every utterance. And so he manages to function at a very high level and attract a lot of support from, you know, you would assume very smart people. And I view Trump as someone like that, but he's functioning at a very high level in a very different context because he's evil Chauncey Gardner. And he's evil in respect to all the norms he will violate, right? Because he has no shame, because he is just the crassest, most self-serving person anyone has ever met, he really warps the reality of politics around him, and people kind of fall into line, and people interpret much of what he does as four-dimensional chess because of all the contradictions don't make any sense, and the unnecessary suffering and chaos doesn't make any sense, and so there must be some deeper motive here. I don't think there's a deeper motive much of the time. I think it's just he's got some dumb idea that's been rattling around his brain since he was, you know, 25 years old. He never reads a book. He watches himself on television. This is his information diet, right? So he's got a lot of dumb ideas. He's had dumb ideas about tariffs for more than half his life, and we're living with the consequences of those. People perceive it to be, you know, deep and Machiavellian in some kind of brilliant way, but no, it's just he's managed to find an orbit through our sick culture, which is working for him because of the status of the culture.
Yeah. Well, given that everyone got it wrong about take him seriously, not literally, it seems we're going to take Greenland. And the question is, do you think we're going to give it back later under new leadership? And then I guess rolled up into that, what does a mea culpa from the U.S. look like after this current era? And if it's possible?
I still don't have an intuition around what's going to happen with Greenland. I mean, I think it's quite possible that he will back off, having wrung some concession from someone, and call it the art of the deal. But yeah, I mean, taking Greenland in any kind of bullying way, I think that is as bad for the liberal world order as the most hysterical people say it is. I mean, it's just insane. We're threatening a NATO ally with war, effectively, to steal part of their territory for no apparent reason. And I mean, it's just, and Congress isn't saying a word about it. And boy, there's like five people in Congress who have demurred on this point, or among Republicans. I don't know what a mea culpa would look like. I think a mea culpa, I mean, if we had a sane Democratic president in 2028, I have no hope that anyone would do this, but I think the right thing to do would be to figure out how to limit the powers of the presidency. We have a problem with the powers of the executive, and this is actually something that David French spoke about on my podcast when he was on, but there really actually needs to be a constitutional amendment to clarify the powers of the executive branch. But short of that, I mean, I think we need a Democratic president who, seemingly against his or her own interests, will actively try to reframe the presidency along saner lines so as to close the door to this kind of thing in the future. What we have, I mean, what we clearly don't have is a constitutional order that can protect us against an aspiring autocrat, especially when his party in Congress doesn't care to maintain the integrity or independence of their institution, right? Because all the members of his party in Congress feel that their political futures require pure loyalty, right? Because they're going to be primaried. And so we don't have a Congress, right? We don't have the checks and balances that the Constitution seems to have enshrined, right? So we need to figure out how to solve for this. Trump, with all his excesses, has managed to expose how weak our Constitution is on this front. And I do think a Democratic president could come into office and say, listen, if I do nothing else but effectively clean up the mess that my predecessor has made and make sure it can't be made again by a Republican or a Democrat in the future, that will be a successful presidency. And then, you know, a mea culpa to the rest of the world will be appropriate. I don't know if it'll be convincing, because what we've shown the rest of the world is that half of our society is so out of touch with the needs of, you know, our global civilization at this moment, right? And the needs for cooperation beyond the level of a nation state, that we're capable in any 4-year period of telling the rest of the world to just go fuck itself and to promote some guy who knows nothing and is just purely corrupt, who's going to tariff them in his own, you know, version of an extortion racket, and they're going to have to live with this for 4 years. Right, we've proven that, and so I don't know how you successfully apologize for that and say we'll never do it again when we're always just one election away from doing that again. Unless we perform surgery on the presidency and manage to make it impossible for a president to do this again.
Yeah, well, notwithstanding Trump's actions in many other places, if he takes Greenland, it'll be the first time I really feel concerned about there being free and fair elections in 2028.
I don't know. I don't think there's any linkage between those two things. I mean, I think he is as malevolent as his worst detractors imagine. I mean, I think he's not. I mean, I do think reality is, as I said in our Slack the other day. I mean, you guys asked me what I was thinking about Heather Cox Richardson, and I guess you could put Timothy Snyder in the same bucket. I mean, these are people who have been, to my ear, I mean, while they've been very articulate about the problem we're facing of, you know, creeping authoritarianism, to my ear, they've always been a little too shrill, not to say paranoid, but or hysterical. But I mean, I think reality is catching up to their paranoia at this point. With respect to the elections and the midterms in 2028, I mean, the real bulwark against our democracy being stolen from us there is the fact that we don't have a centralized election authority, right? We have the principle of federalism, and I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of counties that run their own elections, right? So the fact that, I mean, we should be very, very thankful that the bright ideas that many people had, you know, once we got the internet, were never followed up on. That I remember many people, I hope I was not one of these people, but many people at various points in the last quarter century opined that what we really needed was, you know, a vote by internet, you know, national election infrastructure where it would just be super easy to vote, and this is a single choke point on, you know, 300 million votes. That would be a disaster, right? I mean, that would be a condition where we could all wake up on a, you know, Wednesday morning and realize that there's no way of knowing what is real, right? And the autocrat who's claiming to have won the election by 75%, there's no way to tell he's lying, right? So, and yet we all know he is. So we're not in that situation, and we should never allow ourselves to be put in that situation. And so I'm sure whatever Trump can do to mess with the election he will attempt to do. And I think we should all be alert around the messaging here in advance. I mean, he's going to call the midterms fraudulent. I mean, it's all that needs to be priced in, and we need to develop our informational immune system against, you know, all of those claims of fraud. I mean, election fraud in America is not really a thing, right? I mean, it's a rounding error on a rounding error. I mean, everyone has chased this down, even right of center. I think the Heritage Foundation once did a report on election fraud, and they found almost nothing, right? So this is not a real problem, but I'm sure the Steve Bannons of the world and the Stephen Millers of the world are doing their best to erode whatever can be eroded there.
Okay, let's take a quick pause and cleanse our palates for a moment by watching a little bit of this video of Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada. Kirby, can we play this clip for a second?
It's our country. It's your future. And we are going to give it back to you. For decades, Canada's economy became more closely linked to the United States. The U.S. is the world's largest economy, so on the one hand, that created tons of new business and jobs for us. But it also meant that when things change suddenly for the worse down there, it causes big problems up here, and it's hard to control what happens next. As Prime Minister, my number one focus is to put Canadians back in control by building here at home and building new partnerships abroad.
Well, he's making Canada great again. That's great.
Really doing it. But yeah. Well, when was the last time you saw a video like that in our country that was that uplifting and inspiring? It's been a while.
But I'm saying that this is a somewhat salutary effect that Trump has had on Canada. Not really. I mean, I think all of these erstwhile allies are now moving toward China and themselves and other collaborators because we have proven to be so hostile and unreliable. I mean, we're openly contemptuous of our friends and openly admiring of our enemies. I mean, that's the message Trump has sent. It's insane, but it's provoked a reaction. It's a totally rational reaction. They need to figure out how to work around us.
Yeah. Well, I was just more sharing it to show you that I think somebody like that could come along in this country and put a video together like that, and we could all feel inspired and hopeful again.
Yeah, although I don't know. I mean, frankly, I don't know if onshoring all of that supply chain stuff is actually right from an economic point of view. I think that might be a sign of a regression and not progress. But I mean, obviously, some things we want onshored. But
I just mean more of the spirit of it, that like watching somebody, when I saw that video pop up, I thought, God, it's been a long time since we've had something like that. It feels good, regardless of what he's talking about. Okay, let's talk about Iran. The latest estimates I've heard are that between 12,000 and 16,000 protesters have been killed. As these horrifying accounts come out, where's all the support on college campuses and Hollywood, and what would you like to see happen over there in terms of America's involvement?
Well, that's a question we should have been asking for years, right? I mean, there have been all of these uprisings in Iran in the last decade or so, especially from women, you know, and they were met with just great waves of apathy over here among people who pretend to care about the rights of women and care about the oppression of people throughout the world and their Muslim brothers and sisters across the globe. You know, they certainly cared about Gaza, but when you're talking about an Islamic theocracy executing and torturing its own citizens, there's no real compassion, there's no real concern. It's easy to see why that's so. I mean, there's just they can't figure out how to do the moral math on it, because they would seem to be demonizing Islam and another group of Muslims and a non-white group of people if they shined too bright a light on the regime. So it's just, if you have Muslims killing or oppressing other Muslims, no one on the left cares, right? And really, the numbers don't even matter. I mean, the numbers can be tenfold or more greater than the worst estimates of what's happened in Gaza, and no one cares, you know, in Syria or Yemen or Sudan. I mean, it's just not a thing to even care about that, or even to report about it for the most part in the mainstream media. But if you have Jews killing Muslims for any reason, even in the immediate aftermath of the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, that is a moral emergency on the left, right? So that's how their moral intuitions are calibrated, and we must try to reset those weightings at some point, because none of that's going to age well, right? I mean, this is, you know, we're going to continue to see conflict with Islamists and jihadists at the borders and even internal to scores of open societies. And we should absolutely be standing with the people of Iran. We should be doing what we can do to engineer a regime change. We should have done this ages ago. This is a failing. This is a bipartisan failing. Obama was terrible on this. Biden was terrible on this. It's a scandal of around both their presidencies that they were so bad on this issue. Trump has been better on this, but Trump, I mean, we can see now that Trump's real concern is not democracy, it's not freedom, it's a, you know, really doesn't have a humanitarian bone in his body. He has other calculations.
What are his other calculations for Iran right now?
Well, I mean, he's got, his support of Israel is, you know, I guess semi-heartfelt. I'm not quite sure how deep it runs. Again, I don't think he really cares about human suffering on any level. So he's kind of accidentally on the right side of this one. I think he hates immigration. He probably hates Islam. He probably hates, you know, he hates Muslims coming into our society from shithole countries. He hates that for Europe. So by, you know, on the basis of that animosity and that xenophobia, he'll be on the right side of this issue, at least some of the time. But he's, you know, happy to do deals with many, you know, Gulf leaders. He's a big fan of MBS, and he's not a fan of those guys for the right reasons. I mean, so like, you know, you can be a fan of MBS to the degree that he's actually sidelining his own hardline clerics and representing some kind of secular progress for the region. And I think that, you know, the Abraham Accords, all of that's good, all of that's moving in the right direction. But these guys are, many of these guys are odious psychopaths and who were exporting their jihadism for decades prior to yesterday. Qatar is still a supporter of terrorism and informed by the theology of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'm sure Trump would be happy to collaborate with Qatar, right? So it's, there's no, he doesn't have a compass for the real issue here. He's just a grifting lunatic who sees a lot of wealth in the Gulf and is just trying to figure out how to maximize his participation in all of that. And, you know, the Gulf is at odds with Iran. Israel's at odds with Iran. Iran, therefore, should be treated as an enemy, but he's not really tracking the emergency that we're seeing in front of us with the regime killing innocent protesters.
But didn't the Gulf states and Israel try to talk him out of engaging?
I did hear that, and I don't know what to make of it. I mean, it could be that Israel was not prepared to deal with any kind of immediate attack from Iran. I have no idea what is going on there, but I did hear that that was the case.
Are you wanting to see American military involvement in Iran to help liberate the
people? I think we should all be very squeamish at this point around American boots on the ground in any of these countries. But if we can use air power or special forces to implement a regime change at this moment, I mean, it seems like the regime is closer to toppling than it's ever been. And it is just an objectively evil regime, right? So this is a moment, again, I don't know what to hope for in the aftermath of this. I think the Iranian people are willing to roll the dice with an aftermath. I think the popular support for the regime is probably around 20% or so, but it's certainly unlikely to be 50%. So I think a majority of Iranians, again, I'm just going on the basis of, you know, the journalism I've read on this front, but it sounds like the majority of Iranians have for a long time been fed up with theocracy and for good reason. So,
I mean, and that's not a shithole. That is not a shithole country. I mean, that country will bounce back quickly.
No, no. And it's an amazing culture. I mean, it's just, it's different from, you know, we risk drawing the wrong lesson from our misadventures overseas by grouping all these countries into the same bin. I mean, Iran is not Afghanistan and Iraq wasn't Afghanistan. I mean, there's just, you know, they're not, they both failed, but it's reasonable to consider them to have been quite different and to still be quite different.
Right. And Venezuela, just while you're talking about that, is also not Afghanistan.
Yeah. So the aftermath there, I mean, the aftermath in Venezuela could be pretty ugly. I have no idea what to expect, but I certainly don't expect anything like what we saw in Iraq or Afghanistan, because we're talking about a country that has known democracy, wants democracy, it knows what it's like to have real institutions, is not riven by religious sectarianism. I mean, it's just, you know, there's a crime syndicate problem, no doubt, but anyway, no, there's zero evidence that the Trump administration is tracking any of the real humanitarian concerns in any of these countries. But I do think that we and Israel And anyone else who wants to have a hand in it should give a little nudge to Iran in whatever way that can be done without, you know, needless loss of civilian life, so as to accomplish regime change there. I mean, it's been too long.
That'd be great. Well, I know you need no help in trashing Trump, but did you see where the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Machado, gave Trump her Nobel Prize and he accepted it?
He accepted it. I mean, that is just the most amazing thing. I mean, it's amazing that he wants it that bad. It's amazing that it so obviously warps his thinking across. I mean, it warped his thinking about Venezuela. I mean, apparently one of the reasons why he did not consider her as the successor to Maduro, even though she's got the most popular support in the country, is because she won the Nobel Prize that he thought he deserved. It's even infected his thinking around Greenland. I mean, we have the bizarre note he wrote. I mean, the most childish, farcical, embarrassing communication he wrote. I mean, he wrote when he typed with his thumbs to the Prime Minister of Norway, claiming that now since he wasn't given the Nobel Peace Prize, now peace isn't such a priority of his, and that's why he's going so hard after Denmark, right? I mean, so like if you'd given me a prize for my peacefulness, then I'd be more peaceful. But now I'm a maniac. But to have said it's a great honor to accept it, and it's a real embarrassment to Norway that they gave this woman the prize in the first place. I mean, it's just, again, I default back to, you know, the man is scarcely sane. You've never met anyone who's ever met anyone whose ego was so warped as to behave this way. I mean, if you try to map his behavior onto normal egoic relations among people, you recognize that it is, in fact, unrecognizable. I mean, you just do not see people speak about themselves in this way, thinking that they look good. Again, he's so in a bubble, right, that he just does like the normal tests of, you know, shaming and embarrassment and kind of indiscretion. Like, there's just he's living without gravity. So there's no social gravity at all. People just keep handing him solid gold pieces of crap, you know, whether it's Apple or it's, you know, the Swiss. You know, he puts the Swiss with tariffs and they delivered him I think it was a solid kilogram of pure gold inscribed to him. And then some fancy Rolex clock so as to get those tariffs removed. I mean, like, this is the world he's in. He does something stupid and people literally show up with kilograms of gold.
Well, I hope I don't embarrass you here, but could you name, how about three of the eight wars that Trump has ended?
The eight plus. I think it was eight. I think he said eight and a quarter wars.
Just name three.
Well, of course, many of those were not wars. And I think some were just kind of skirmishes that lasted a day. I don't know. I think he credits himself, obviously, with Gaza. But then there's India and Pakistan. I think he's got Thailand and Cambodia. I think he had something in Nigeria. I forget what else he's got.
Maybe he did something with Dennis Rodman in the first term with North Korea, right? Wasn't he a part of that?
Yeah, I don't remember that. No.
I mean, there was a time where North Korea was a real threat.
Dennis Rodman accomplished more with, you know, all of his nose rings in that diplomacy than Trump accomplished on some of these claimed.
Well, speaking of Dennis Rodman, have you checked out any of these sports gambling apps or these prediction market apps, Kalshi or Polymarket? You know what I'm talking about?
I've just glanced at them. I've never really spent any time on them. I mean, I know they exist and I know that it's a little scary that they exist. I mean, obviously the prospect of insider trading is all too obvious. I mean, you know you're going to send Delta Force in to get Maduro. And so you can bet on Maduro being ousted by the end of the month. I think someone made like 400 grand on a bet there.
Yeah, well, I mean, not just that. I mean, obviously that's scary, but you know, this is just building on the gambling apps that are just putting Vegas in people's pockets. I mean, this cannot end well at some point. You know, people don't go to Vegas and win, and they're not going to win eventually in their pockets. And
although I think we're there, I mean, arguably this is better than ordinary, leaving aside insider trading, which I think is a little scary here, but it's arguably better than ordinary gambling because at least it has this secondary benefit of giving us some informational signal, right? When you see where the gambling market is on a world event, if it's not strangely biased for some reason, you're getting some of the wisdom of the crowds. I mean, because people's willingness to place money on outcomes is a better signal than most of their conviction that something's going to happen. So,
did you get a chance to see Ben Shapiro on Gavin Newsom's podcast? I know we have him coming up next month.
Yeah, unfortunately, not yet. No, I saw that he was on. I think I saw a clip or two, but I did not see the the whole episode.
I thought it was good. I always like when opposite sides sit down to talk for several reasons. And one of those is, you've often said that conversation is all we have standing between us and violence. And so I'm always happy to see that happen.
I think it's good. I mean, I was not a fan of what Newsom did with, it might've been his first or second episode. I mean, I think he had one with Steve Bannon and one with Charlie Kirk. And I thought the one with Charlie Kirk was pretty abject in just how he kind of fawned over Kirk's success as a organizer without drilling down on anything that was so obviously wrong with his politics. So, yeah.
Is there anything that you're looking forward to talking to Ben about at this point?
Yeah, I'm interested to see if his view of Trump has changed at all, right? Or, I mean, he was, I last left him being a debate opponent who assured me that there would be no tariffs because you have to take him seriously and not literally. So clearly that his thinking on that front should have changed. I just think I want to know where the line is with a lot of these people who have been supporting Trump up until, you know, right up to the precipice and one could argue over. And I mean, Ben and I obviously agree about much of the dysfunction we now see right of center, the anti-Semitism, the uncertainty around just how many Nazis we want in the big tent. So, you know, there won't be much daylight between our view of our respective views of people like Tucker Carlson or Candace Owens, but I just think it'll be interesting to dig in to all of that with him because, you know, frankly, I think he is culpable for where the Republican Party got to some degree. I mean, obviously he's culpable for Candace in large measure, having given her her first real platform.
Well, I mean, she wasn't the same Candace.
Oh yeah, she was.
I think she was?
I mean, from 1,000 miles away, I knew he shouldn't have hired Candace.
But she still wasn't, you think she's the same Candace or she just got worse?
No, she was just a totally unprincipled conspiracy nut and dummy. I mean, she's a dummy, not in the sense, I mean, she's very smart and talented in one way, you know, as a broadcaster, she's extremely talented, but she's just a dummy when you're, you know, I don't know where her being dumb or in her just being unprincipled, I don't know what the frontier is between those two things, but you know, whether she's lying or whether she's just dumb, you know, what the kinds of things she thinks are true are embarrassing, and they were embarrassing back then, right? So
Ben had a prediction on the podcast that the Republicans were going to have a tough time in the midterms. Do you think that Dems can hold it together long enough to get some seats back, or are you worried that they might do something stupid to shift the tide back again where people say, oh God, they're doing that thing again?
Yeah. I mean, I do worry that we're always capable of being as stupid as we were in 2019 or 2020. I mean, I think we were talking about this in Slack. Someone sent us the
Josh Hawley video, that really nice doctor.
The Josh Hawley video. I don't know when that was from, but he's talking to some doctor or, you know, putative doctor about...
Who's very lovely. She seems like she could, you know, the nicest person in the world.
I mean, yeah, it seemed like she had taken... a fistful of beta blockers before that. So she was really, you know, very low cortisol, despite the fact that she was giving us the most embarrassing rendition of, you know, the woke priestess from the temple of Wokistan, I mean, which is awful. And, you know, I mean, I'm no fan of Josh Hawley's, but he's, you know, he was perfect in that mortifying interrogation of her. What I fear is that for her audience, her stonewalling and gaslighting and far left lunacy was successful. I mean, I bet she came off that stage and got high fives from some very misguided far left activists in the Democratic Party. That's the end, right? I mean, I recommend people watch this footage. You know, maybe we can put a link to it.
This isn't hard, doctor. Can men get pregnant? Yes or no?
I would be more than happy to have a conversation with you that is not coming from a place of trying to be polarized and push.
I'm not trying to be polarizing. I'm trying to ask. I think it is extraordinary that we are here in a hearing about science and about women. And for the record, it's women who get pregnant, not men.
That is a hill that more than half the country will be willing to die on, right? I mean, that is absolute suicide for the Democrats. And there need be no other issue. And I don't think there's anything Trump could do, I'm including getting us into a war with Denmark, that more Americans will care about than that issue. For whatever reason, that issue is a super stimulus, right? And it's So if we don't get religion on that and figure out how to make that the last video anyone ever sees like that in human history, I think things are very dire for us.
Right. I was going to say this topic reminds me of a really funny tweet from a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it. Somebody wrote, whether it's Democrats putting their pronouns in email signatures or Republicans shooting and killing unarmed drivers, both sides have taken actions at the other side that the other side finds threatening. That was really good.
No, I mean, it's completely out of balance. I mean, there's just no, I agree that those kinds of comparisons make it look ridiculous, but I just know in my bones that that issue, it is an unrecoverable error for Democrats to sing this from the same hymn book on trans activism. It will be the end, and it will never stop being the end.
Yeah. Well, I just sort of a housekeeping note. I do sense that this series, More from Sam, might need to become more of an ongoing conversation given the current landscape. And it's just a shame because I really think it's such an opportunity cost for you and for all of us who have to spend time on this, but I don't see any way for you to ignore it. I mean, you're just going to have to keep making sense of it. I know plenty in your audience want to hear you talk about philosophy and science and how to live a better life, but I think we'll be doing this a little bit more frequently, for better or for worse.
Yeah, I mean, I view it the same way. I mean, I do view politics as a colossal opportunity cost for everyone, but especially personally, I feel that it is because it's not where my heart is, right? Like, I'm not a political person. I feel every hour that I speak and think about politics is a sign of a pathology in our culture. It's just like, this is not where I want my attention to go. So yeah, and now obviously I will have episodes of the podcast that totally break free from the tractor beam of current events, but we'll have to keep coming back to this until something fundamentally changes.
Yeah, well, hopefully it does, but I don't see that happening. All right, now it's time for the lightning round.
Oh yeah.
Wes,
I'm ready.
Here we go. Wes Moore or Gavin Newsom for 2028?
Well, so I actually met Wes Moore and found him incredibly impressive. I mean, he really seemed like, you know, Barack Obama, who you played football and fought in Afghanistan, kind of impressive. I mean, just really, the interpersonal effect on the 12 or so people who met him that day. But I do worry, I think there may be, he might have some skeletons in his closet that I don't know about. I mean, I've since heard that there's some issues there that he's going to, you know, in a national election, he's going to have to be vetted. I mean, people can fact check me on this, but there was something around deception or misstatements, at least around his academic background or some part of his background. Again, there's no there, but I've heard rumors to that effect. So I worry about that. I mean, he really needs to, it seems strange to think that any of that would matter in the current environment, given who he's likely to be running against and if he runs. But no, I found him very impressive and very inspiring. And he really seemed like he had his head screwed on straight around wokeness and identity politics. And being Black, he has the superpower of being able to call bullshit on all that in a way that a white guy can't, unfortunately. And having spoken to another likely candidate who happened to be white, I could see the difference, right? I mean, here was a candidate who, I'm not going to name him, but, you know, another prominent politician who, when asked the same questions about identity politics and wokeness and all of that, just, it's like he's been asleep for the last 5 years and or 6 years and thought it was 2020 because he was just doing all the land acknowledgments and other craziness every third sentence. And again, the spell has to be broken, and it might take a person of color to do it, but man, we have to do it yesterday.
Moving on, Scott Adams passed away recently. We had him on the show in 2017. He's a complicated guy. How did you feel about that, his passing?
Honestly, the whole thing just made me very sad, really. I mean, I didn't know him. I only had that one encounter with him on my podcast. People can listen to that. That was early in the first Trump administration, I think. I mean, obviously we didn't agree about much. And not knowing him, I don't know how much was to attribute to his personality going back many, many years, or to attribute to his entanglement with his own audience and with our media tools and, you know, social media in particular. But I just, you know, I viewed it just like a reading his obituary. It just seemed all very sad to see how indelible all of that awfulness was, you know, for his reputation. I mean, I saw him as someone who just seemed to get radicalized by his his use of social media. I mean, the algorithm radicalized him, his own audience radicalized him. He decided to touch this particular third rail. Not even, I mean, in ways that many people have touched it. I mean, I've even touched it, but he decided to touch it with his face and to kind of make a big show of, you know, the thing that got him canceled was he said, there was some poll. I mean, it might've been a specious poll. I think it was a Rasmussen poll, which I think those skew right of center, but some poll that said from the black community, you know, black people polled saying something like 52% said that, you know, it was not okay to be white or something. I mean, it sounded like a badly worded poll question to my ear. I mean, so I remember when he did this, I was not inclined to make anything of this, but he decided to react and say, well, okay, if they're saying that if over 50% of black people in America say that it's not okay to be white, well then, you know, the black community is effectively a hate group. And I advise, you know, all of my listeners to not go near black people or something like that. Okay. So it's like, you can see what he's on some level. I mean, do I think he was a racist? I actually don't. I mean, or at least I have no, I wouldn't necessarily conclude that on the basis of that statement, given how he framed it. But he's sort of trolling the world and getting, he's taking this provocateur stance that is becoming more and more fashionable, right of center. And then at that moment, he got properly canceled for it, right? He had like all, you know, his cartoons running in hundreds or thousands of papers, all got, you know, all those contracts got canceled, and he really screwed himself. And then obviously his reputation is, you know, if you read his obit, you know, that's a major part of how he's remembered. And, you know, he certainly knew that was going to be the case. I just view him as a casualty of, again, I don't know, I really don't know who he was. So maybe more of this was deserved than I'm being too charitable, but I just view him as somebody who got radicalized by this kind of dumb use of attention on social media. And, these were the consequences.
Speaking of Scott's, I saw that Scott Galloway got a nose job and maybe some more. I don't know. Is there anything that you would do to alter your appearance ever?
I don't have any plans, but I would have taken that nose job. I need a nose job more than he needs a nose job. I would have taken his old nose. But
that's very nice of you.
I mean, I'm not judgmental about it at all. I mean, I think he should do whatever he wants to do.
No, I'm not either. I mean, I've been thinking about getting some little transplants in the front of my hair.
I mean, I just think it's, I have a quasi superstitious view around elective surgery. I mean, if I had to take a risk of death for something and, if that's the way I died, getting a nose job, you know, if my daughters have to show up to my funeral because I got a nose job and never woke up, that would be,
That's a hard one.
That's an own goal of a sort that I really never want to score on myself. So it's I don't know. I'm at this point in life, I'm trying to avoid the most spectacular examples of regret. And that's one on the horizon that I could see. And it seems pretty easy to avoid.
I mean, but you realize people do these every single day and they don't die.
No, but people die of...
From the anesthesia.
I mean, like James Doty, you know, the
of course.
Utterly dear man who, again, I never met in person, but he was on, I think he was on the podcast. He was definitely in the Waking Up app.
Yeah.
The neurosurgeon over at Stanford who did all the work on compassion. And
in the center he had there.
Met with the Dalai Lama and all that. I mean, he died, he's a little bit older than me, but I think he was in his 60s. He died as the result of complications from a hernia surgery. I mean, hernia surgery is not elective. He had, had to have a hernia surgery. But, you know, the guy, he's a Stanford neurosurgeon. You got to think he's getting the best surgical care on planet Earth. He died as a result of
hernia surgery. I knew it was something unexpected. I didn't know that was that.
I think it took a while, too. I don't think he didn't die on the table, but I think he had, like, secondary infections or something. And, so it's totally tragic. And so anyway,
can you just honor him for a second and he has the most incredible story I'd ever heard. You remember that story from 25 years ago? We just told the audience really quickly, just what a mensch this guy was.
I don't think it came out in my interview of him on the podcast or on the app.
He said something about it. And then you just were like, okay, James, I remember calling you going, Sam, what the fuck? Like, that was the craziest story I've ever heard.
Yeah. So what happened is he was a Stanford neurosurgeon, but he also had some medical device that he had invented, or he was an entrepreneur of some description. I forget what the details were around that, but he had started a company during the, I think the first dot-com boom became spectacularly valuable. So he had a ton of money on paper and had pledged some considerable portion of that money to charity.
I think it was like $30 million he pledged.
Yeah, I think he pledged $30 million to charity, but that was in the context of having a lot more money on paper, right? So he had whatever, hundreds of millions, and he pledged $30 million. And then the bubble popped and his wealth evaporated. But for some reason, now I could be getting the details wrong.
The $30 million was still intact.
The spirit of this is right. Yeah, I forget the mechanism, but the $30 million was still intact. Like he had partitioned his equity in some such way that when the bubble popped, and this was just sheer inadvertence, the bubble popped, his money was gone, but the $30 million, which he didn't have to give to charity, was not encumbered by any kind of paperwork. It was just something he had internally committed to, but—
I thought his lawyer had called him and said, I got great news for you. Like that $30 million, we never gave it away. You still
exactly,
have it.
You can take it.
No one will ever know about it.
This is your golden parachute. And he said, no, I pledged that to charity. I'm giving it to charity. Right. So he didn't.
All of it though.
Like he did not have a pot to piss in, I don't think. And he had $30 million that he gave away. Right. So that's, I mean, what a mensch.
Right. But he didn't, anybody else would have said, you know, if you were going to give any of it away, maybe half.
Oh, yeah. You keep.
Nobody gives it all.
You give 15 away and you keep 15. I mean, whatever. I mean, it's like totally, I mean, one in a million people would have made that decision. So.
Anyway, super mensch. Okay, we got some shit for not bringing up Barry Weiss's decision to pull the 60 Minutes episode last time. I think we just all thought the episode was going to air a couple weeks later, and it aired on Sunday. Any thoughts or anything to talk
about? Oh, it did air? I didn't follow that. Were there changes or?
I didn't watch the original, and I didn't watch the airing. It wasn't something to me, so I just wanted to touch on this.
I mean, I agree the optics were bad. I think that was a mistake, all things considered. I don't think it, you know, I wouldn't have read into it the sinister intent that her detractors read and will continue to read into everything she does. I mean, I'm a fan of Barry's. I want her to succeed. And I consider her a friend too. I mean, so that's just the way it is. But I do think what she's signed up for here is a very punishing, thankless job. And I certainly don't know if her tenure there will be successful. I don't know if anyone's could be. And I do worry that the optics around a lot of this is just, the optics are bad and are hard to change, you know? I mean, her collaboration with the Ellisons and I mean, all of that's not great. I can see what the Free Press audience, I mean, it's been a long time since I've looked at it, frankly, but not the Free Press, but the audience. But like when I did that debate with Ben Shapiro right before the election, I looked at what was coming back at me on the Free Press channels, and it was just one MAGA shithead after another. I might as well have done the debate for Breitbart, right? So that had to matter to them, understandably. But again, that's a problem with the business model. That's a problem with the orbit they picked initially. So yeah, I am critical of much of that, but I am still very hopeful that she's going to do a lot of good journalism too. So.
All right. Well, I think that's where we're going to leave it. I got a lot more to talk to you about, but I think we're just going to have to save it for next episode. I want to thank everyone who submitted questions. If you'd like to help with the show in the future, you can head over to Sam's Substack page and submit questions and participate in the online community. And again, if you want tickets to see Sam live, you can go to samharris.org and get all the information there. That's it. Thank you, Sam, and see everyone next time, or you'll hear us next time.
Thank you. See you next time.
Bye-bye.